Most of what I'm going to say is joint work with Ragnar Buchwald, and some of the bits at the end are joint work with Ragnar and with Michelle Vandenberg. So the setup is as follows. K is going to be some field, and in fact, later in the talk, it will stop even being a field and just turn into a ring. Capital X will be the generic n by n matrix over that field. So it has entries x11 up to x1n, all the way down to xnn. In the bottom corner. And its entries lie in this polynomial ring where you just join each one of these xij's and call that S. The adjoint of the title, I will remind you, that the so-called classical adjoint, sometimes if you're old school, called the adjugate, so that sounds like some sort of legal profession, is, I'm going to give you several different ways to describe it. They're all equivalent. It's the transpose of the matrix of cofactors, which, as you remember from introductory linear algebra, are the signed submaximal minors. It's the classical adjoint, let's give you some notation for it, adj of X. Another way to write it is as, again, the transpose of the n minus first exterior power of the matrix X, from which you read off that the entries are in the ij spot, the partial with respect to the variable xji, note the switch because of the transpose, of the determinant of our old friend, the square generic matrix over there. And finally, again equivalently, it is uniquely defined by the equation, which I will write over here. X times its adjoint is the diagonal matrix with the determinant of the generic matrix down the diagonal. This determinant, of course, is a homogeneous polynomial degree n. So what you have is this one polynomial in each spot on the diagonal. And it also is symmetric, like so. Either one of those qualities suffices to define the adjoint. From that last description, from this equation here, springs the question that got us all started, which is due to George Bergman. Think of, well, pick your favorite one of these two equalities, doesn't matter which one, and think of that as a factorization of this diagonal matrix with the determinant down the diagonal. It is, but you don't have to think of it as one, it is one. It's a factorization as a product of two square matrices. question is, can this factorization of this diagonal matrix be refined? And by refined, I mean the following. I mean, I want to write the diagonal guy as a product, y1 up to y, say, r, times z1 up to z, say, s, where the reason I've grouped them like this is that this is x, and this is the adjoint. And I want the factorization to be, again, a factorization in the same sense. So I want the yi's and the zi's square matrices. And I want it not to be dumb. So I don't want any invertible matrices. With their entries in the polynomial ring. And the question should have a question mark. So, one thing to notice immediately, the this determinant, this homogeneous polynomial of degree n, is irreducible in the polynomial ring. So, because we know that determinants are multiplicative, there's no way for this to happen in any non-trivial way. One of these y's would have to be invertible, and that's not what we want. So, x does not factor non-trivially. Thus, the question becomes, just focus on the adjoint, does this factor into a product of two square matrices? And we'll call them y and z, just to collapse the notation a little bit. So this is Bergman's question. And written just in this way, it seems a little odd. Why would you even expect that such a thing might be true? And where do you expect it to take you when you decide whether the answer is yes or no? So Bergman's answer to this question, an almost complete answer, and now let me specialize K a little bit before I generalize him. Let's suppose K is an algebraically closed field of characteristic zero. Then there are two cases. Case one, if n is odd, that's the size of our square matrix, if n is odd, then the answer is no. Where I'm leaving out the part about the non-triviality. We'll assume that. But you can't get to the other cases. The other case is if n is even, then he couldn't quite show that there are no factorizations. But he was able to show that in any putative factorization of this form. There's a restriction on the determinant of either y or of z. Either the determinant of y is equal to the determinant of x, or the determinant of z is equal to the determinant of x. And here's another phrase that I'm going to write once and then ignore, up to units. Of course, you could multiply both matrices by minus one. I don't care about that. So first of all, why is this a restriction at all? Why is it, where does it come from? It comes from, here. Notice from the circled equation up there, that the determinant of the adjoint is the same as the determinant of the generic one to the n minus first power. Also using the irreducibility here. So if you had a factorization like so, the determinants of each of them have to be some power of the determinant of x, and what this says is one of them has to be one. It's a very nearly complete answer to the question. The proof is bizarre and fascinating. It uses the theorem that it actually uses is about embeddings of Grassmannians, but the theorem. Let me say it correctly. The theorem it uses is by De Concini. And Eichstein, which is, as I say, about embeddings of Grassmannians, but is a higher dimensional jazzing up of the topological fact that you can't comb a hedgehog without leaving bald spots. And you can, it's really fun, to use, when n is 3, of course that's in case 1 here, right, n 3 being odd, to use the hairy ball theorem and pretend that your field is the reals just so you can draw pictures to prove this, to, from a factorization, construct a non-vanishing continuous vector field on this sphere. It's generalizing. Fascinating, well, interesting question. Satisfying answer, mostly. Fascinating proof. But it leaves an algebraist with a sort of a funny feeling that topology shouldn't really play that big a role in this question or its answer. There should be an algebraic way to look at this to hopefully at least recover Bergman's result and preferably fill in that one gaping hole there in case 2, and if you're lucky, it'll work over other rings than algebraically closed fields of characteristic 0. So let's translate this into algebra, some commutative algebra. Remember, S is our polynomial ring. Where'd it go? Up there. Let's define a pair of S modules by considering this generic matrix X as a homomorphism between free S modules. This makes perfect sense. And I want to define L to be the co-kernel. And one observes that the determinant is a non-zero divisor in the polynomial ring, and so this is injective. Then I said 2, here's the other one. Define M to be the co-kernel of the adjoint. An application of Cramer's rule is what I always say, but there are other ways to see it. Shows that both L and M are killed by the determinant, this generic determinant over here. So they are modules over what I'm going to call R, which is the hypersurface ring corresponding to this generic determinant. And I left a little space there. Since they have projective dimension 1 over S, they must have maximal depth over R, so they are maximal Cohen-Macaulay R modules, which is where I start to get really excited. In fact, the equation, which is still on the board and still circled, says that X and its adjoint, this matrix X and this matrix adjoint of X, form a matrix factorization of the determinant. It's exactly what that equation says across the top. And so these two modules are, in fact, syzygies of each other over R. Among various other things, yes. This latter part, yes. Who's diagonal? Not simply diagonal, but diagonal with the same thing down the diagonal. Yes. So that translates X and the adjoint, these matrices, into algebraic gadgets. How to translate this, a factorization of the adjoint, into an algebraic gizmo? Well, let's write it. And I think I want a whole board for this. Let's write it diagrammatically, taking our cue from those short exact sequences there. So we have S to the N mapping to S to the N, and a factorization of matrices is a factorization of that map. Giving a triangle like so. And this triangle commutes. Let's put in M and, to be fair, let's put in the co-kernel of Z and the co-kernel of Y. I guess should go up here somewhere. And now trace a diagram. It says that this yellow thing is a short exact sequence of, again, R modules. So to finish this sentence over here, a factorization into Y times Z gives an extension of, again, one checks that they are maximal Cohen-Macaulay R modules, like so, 0 to the co-kernel of Z, I think, yes, to M, this co-kernel of the adjoint, to the co-kernel of Y to 0. One last bit of translation. What does this condition in Bergman's theorem about the determinants mean in terms of these modules? One checks, writes down, that remember, we know that the determinant of Y is some power of the determinant of X. And one checks that that happens if and only if the co-kernel of Y has rank J as an R module, where J is that power, whatever power of the determinant of X. And there should be a unit in there that I'm not writing or saying, except that I just did. So, Bergman's condition in 2 above, and to the right, says that if we have an extension with the co-kernel of the adjoint in the middle, then one of the n's has rank 1. The power of the determinant of X appearing as its determinant is 1. Yeah. Oh, so I meant to say.
Sorry.
Yes. Well, co-kernel of Y certainly is, being a quotient of such a thing, yes. And co-kernel of... No, if you knew that the ends were both annihilated, you would get that the middle was annihilated by the square. But if you get the middle is annihilated, you get both ends on the nose. Yeah. So, I should have said before, translating Bergman's condition, Bergman's question then is, does the co-kernel of the adjoint appear in such an extension? And we saw that rank 1 has something to do with this condition. Here are two facts relevant at this point. One is that the rank 1 maximal Cohen-Macaulay R modules are known. Yes? In fact, there are 3 up to isomorphism. There is the ring itself. Can't get away from that one. There is L. Is L still on the board? L is still on the board. It's the co-kernel of our generic matrix. And there is what I'm going to call L star, which is the co-kernel of its transpose. This is a factor de Bruns, I believe. Oh, so that's going to help an awful lot. We just got a bizarrely infinite huge problem down to 1, 2, 3. Second, the divisor class group of R, this hypersurface ring, is isomorphic to one copy of the integers. Well, direct sum, the divisor class group of whatever ground ring it was, generated with this Z copy. Generated by the class of this rank 1 L, which a moment's thought will convince you that that's the negative of the class of L star, and also the negative of the class of this M. The reason for that being directly above that they're syzygies of each other. This already gets us part of Bergman's result, a slight jazzing up of part of Bergman's result. Suppose K, this is the part where K gets more general. Suppose K is a UFD, and that you're in the case of a 3x3 matrix. Tiny little 3x3 matrix. Then the adjoint has no non-trivial. Factorizations. Remember, this is the case that you can do pretty much directly from the Hedgehog theorem, or you can now do it algebraically over different rings. And the proof is just a calculation in the class group, which I told you what it was over there. If I have an extension, using the deep fact that if n is 3, n minus 1 is 2. So if I've got an extension where the middle has rank 2, and it's supposed to be a non-trivial sort of thing, the ends had better have rank 1 each, and I know all the rank 1s. 1, 2, 3. But classes in the divisor class group are supposed to be additive along exact sequences. And you just use those relations on the bottom of that far right-hand board to convince yourself that this can't happen. Yes, well, with those relations, you get that one of the ends has to be R, but this ring is Gorenstein, so R can't appear in the front or the back, non-trivially. Thank you. Now we're feeling pretty good. The ring is Gorenstein. So first of all, R can't appear here on the right-hand end non-trivially because it's projective, and so the thing would split. Secondly, because it's Gorenstein, it's injective in the category of maximal Cohen-Macaulay modules, so it would split from this end as well. Now, for n bigger than 3, it's not the case that both ends of an extension, like the one I'm pointing at, would have to have rank 1. But if we're going to try to fill the whole, or the, what's a polite way to speak about the Mann's theorem, to rule out the case that Bergman's theorem left open, perhaps we should assume that one of our ends has rank 1. So let's... For general n, let's now assume that, first of all, that we've got a factorization, and let's assume that, just for this talk, let's have the determinant of z equal to the determinant of x. You could treat the other case essentially symmetrically, the determinant of y having the determinant of x. And let's try to rule this out. Then we know that the co-kernel of Z is either isomorphic to L or isomorphic to L star, not R for the reasons we mentioned a minute ago. So let's draw another good-sized diagram. Bring that information into play. So here's my extension. Where the left-hand end is either L or L star. Arrows going the other way. Yes, I do. Using the fact that the first syzygy of M is L, write a perpendicular exact sequence like so, and take the pullback of these two maps, resulting in something like so. You also get maps across and equalities. Here. Oops, one more. So this is a pullback diagram from the two maps with target M, giving me here in the left column something whose ends I know. Sort of. I know I'm up to a star or a no star. And the assertion is that if the top row is a non-split, meaning an honest extension, then so is the left-hand column. So we get an element of either, well, there are two options for the terminal end. So it's either of x1 over r of LL or x1 over r L star by L. So the existence of a factorization would imply the existence of a non-zero element in these x guys, which now involve no unknown, no y's or z's. So what's the first thing in your head? given where we are, where we are. One runs away to Macaulay 2. 35 minutes in. Ask the oracle, are these things zero? And the oracle very helpfully comes back. So I'll put theorem in quotes. Sure. That x1 of L comma L is zero. This is what we asked the oracle. It's direct from the oracle's mouth. At least up to n equals, I think I only got, yeah. So maybe the quote should be on around the whole thing. Right, I think I once got n equals 7 to go. I just didn't use my computer for 3 days. But, and it was true up to n equals 7, so it must be true for real, and so we could prove it. And we could erase these things here. And it is an actual theorem that we proved. Using an explicit complex sometimes called the Scandinavian complex, being due to a couple of, I think, Danes. With homology in one place, this X group that we care about, and which is known to be exact in the generic case. So we're looking very good. Return to the oracle, make the appropriate sacrifices, return with another quoted theorem, which is, which way do I have it? L star L, yeah. That this is not zero. You get an answer back that is non-zero. Sort of a letdown, I know, at this point in the story. But perhaps we should revise our expectations. We were expecting to prove that these things were zero, follow the trail of ideas back, and fill in that remaining case in Bergman's theorem. Perhaps there's something in that case. There's a reason it's there. So, how to describe this X? And really, that's code for turn its elements. Into factorizations, climb back up the chain of ideas. Well, one can ask the oracle. The oracle returns some numbers of generators. Let's see if I... This was 2 years ago. I wanted to answer in finite time. The oracle returns a sequence of numbers. The number of generators of this X. As many ends as you can have the patience to ask it. We didn't think to plug it into Sloan's. Whose idea was that? Was Alex's idea. We didn't think to plug it in the Encyclopedia of Sequences. But if we had, we would have been sort of embarrassed when it came back and said, in fact, those are. And choose two. I vividly remember the day that Reinhard turned to me and said, six is four, choose two. I'll be damned, you're right, it is. So, but what to do with that? Well, here's how to get that in play. From the short exact sequence, which one do I want? Let's have this one, where I haven't yet introduced M star, but I hope it's guessable what that would be. That's the co-kernel of the transpose of the adjoint. We get a surjection from Hom M star L onto this X that we're currently worried about. And the oracle returns the same sequence of numbers for the number of generators of that HOM. Leading us to this theorem, which has no quotes, which is that that HOM module, so just to slow down and make sure, this is very concrete stuff. This is the co-kernel of the n minus first exterior power of X into the co-kernel of X is a maximal Cohen-Macaulay R module. It's the first moderately surprising thing. With S-free resolution of this shape, where the map in the middle, I wrote down to make sure I didn't, yes, second exterior power of our matrix X. Maybe it's informative to make some identifications here. Let's identify the free module of rank n choose 2 with the module of alternating n by n matrices. This is, again, a free module of the same rank. They are identified. And alternating means skew symmetric, and also the diagonal is zero. You have to throw that in characteristic two. So let's make those two identifications. Then this map becomes the map that sends an alternating matrix, say A, to X transpose AX. Which, of course, is, again, alternating. And from this, one gets, I'll call it a corollary, I suppose, that for each alternating n by n matrix A, again still over our polynomial ring S, there exists a unique alternating B of the same size, so that A times the adjoint of X is equal to X transpose times B. And in fact, it's not, a corollary is probably the wrong word. If this is, porism might be the right word. It's from the proof you realize that this is the truth, not from the statement. But a true corollary to that is the following. If n is even, then something about alternating matrices in even size. In odd size, they have to have determinant zero. But even size, they don't. There exists invertible alternating matrices A. And then, you can multiply it to the other side and get one of the factorizations allowed by Bergman's theorem. One more corollary. It's doing that funny thing again, for just before it shorted out last time. I hope my last words aren't adjoint. So another corollary. Let n be arbitrary, then we saw, where is it? Oh yes, there's a surjection from this Hom module, which we now have an explicit resolution for, to this X module, which is what we decided we cared about for a little while there at least. And this gives, for each alternating n by n matrix A, there exists a short exact sequence, or an extension, of this form, with Q an indecomposable non-zero, an indecomposable orientable rank 2 maximal Cohen-Macaulay R module. The indecomposability, the only way it could decompose is as the direct sum of the outer ends by Miata's theorem, and you just check that that can't happen. Except this is a lie. Right, sorry. Let's strike that word indecomposable. What I really want to say is, given A and A prime, get two extensions which are equal in X1 if and only if the difference A minus A prime is a left multiple of X transpose. So that this comes from analyzing the kernel of this map here. Now, in the last couple of minutes, I want to just mention briefly the desingularization part. You may have noticed that there was a whole half the title that didn't get any play. So recall, hopefully it's still on the board. Oh, yes, it's just up there. That this HOM is a maximal Kolmogorov-Macaulay R module. It has other things going for it as well, but in particular, it's maximal Kolmogorov-Macaulay. And this reminded us of things that I've been reading sort of separately at the time, for which I need a definition. Let R be a local. This is the first time in the whole talk that R has been anything other than that hypersurface ring. It's now a little more general. Local, normal, Gorenstein domain. In particular, the old R would have worked fine. A non-commutative crepant resolution of R is an algebra, an R algebra, of the form, I'll call it lambda, of the form endomorphism ring of some module over R, with M a reflexive R module, and satisfying two properties. First, I need that the global dimension of this lambda is equal to the dimension of my ring. In particular, it's finite. And second, in addition to, well, as part of being an R algebra, it's an R module. And as an R module, I want it to be maximal Kolmogorov-Macaulay. So this definition is due to Vandenberg. So, yes, this is meant to be a non-commutative replacement for resolution singularities. It's here you see smoothness. Yeah. Here you maybe sort of kind of almost see proper birationalness. Maybe you don't. Maybe I don't either. But this also, the fact that it's an endomorphism ring. I'm being a little glib. I can tell you more later if you want. Right. So we're, instead of birational, we're now thinking Morita equivalence. What does this have to do with anything? let me reset my notation a little bit. Return to R being now back to its friendly old hypersurface self. And for integers A, from say 0 up to n minus 1, let's put M sub A to be the co-kernel of the eighth exterior power of our matrix X. So in particular, M sub 1 is what we used to call L, where the two sides of that equality live in different worlds. But and M sub N minus 1, this is the co-kernel of the N minus first exterior power, which is the transpose of the adjoint. So this is what we used to call M star from the middle board there. And then, of course, there are a whole bunch in between. And it's been 22 minutes since we visited the Oracle. This is another quoted theorem from the computational evidence, which is that not only is that one Hom, which you see is Hom from n minus 1 to m1, but all of the intermediate homomorphism modules between these MAs and MBs are all maximal Kolmogorov. So this is the big direct sum over A's and B's of Hom MA MB as a module. It also has a ring structure. Which this computational evidence, together with this sort of side bedtime light reading, suggested, what's now the theorem, and this is the part where it's now joined with Wagner Buchweitz and Michelle Vandenberg, that this endomorphism ring, take the direct sum of all these co-kernels of all these exterior powers of the generic matrix and take its endomorphism ring, is non-commutative crepant resolution of our ring R. And I have 28 seconds to tell you about the proof. Let me just not even try. Sorry. I'd be happy to talk more about it after. This is more or less what I wanted to say. Thanks for listening.